This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this edition of the program.
Last night, operating on my orders, the United States military forces successfully moved a major terrorist threat to the world, the global leader of ISIS, known as Haji Abdullah. He took over as leader of ISIS in 2019 after the United States counterterrorism operation killed al-Baghdadi. Since then, ISIS has directed terrorist operations targeting Americans, our allies and our partners, and countless civilians in the Middle East, Africa, and in South Asia. Haji Abdullah oversaw the spread of ISIS-affiliated terrorist groups around the world.
U.S. President Joe Biden on February 3rd announcing to the world the death of ISIS leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi, also known as Haji Abdullah. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. President Biden went on to say that the operation was, quote, a testament to America's reach and capability to take out terrorist threats, to protect this country, and will continue working with our close allies and partners, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Iraqi security forces, including the Kurdish Peshmerga, and more than 80 members of the global coalition to keep pressure on ISIS to protect our homeland. Closed quote. On this edition of the program, we will discuss with our expert panelists the significance and implications of the death of the ISIS leader, the threat that the extremist ideology, which fuels the so-called Islamic State, continues to pose, notwithstanding the elimination of key leaders like Haji Abdullah, and much more. So for more on the ramifications of the U.S. raid, the status of ISIS and its sleeper cells, we turn to two Middle East and counterterrorism experts. Brian Katulis is Vice President for Policy at the Middle East Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Jennifer Caffarella, she is a Syria expert, and she is Chief of Staff and inaugural National Security Fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, Jennifer, let's begin with you. Jennifer, what is the significance of this raid that I just referred to, its timing, and the death of ISIS, or as we say in Arabic, Daesh leader al-Qureshi? And let me just say this, that he is known as the one who engineered the genocide campaign against the minority Yazidi population in Iraq.
Look, anytime you eliminate a terrorist leader from the battlefield and somebody at this echelon within a global terrorist organization, it is unquestionably a win. In this case, it is also testament to the continued reach and professionalism of U.S. Special Forces and Special Operations Forces, who continue to put pressure on global networks, including both ISIS and al-Qaeda. I think in this case, it will take some time, as it usually does when one eliminates a senior jihadist leader, to evaluate the full effect of his elimination from the battlefield, including to determine how deeply involved was he, both in current operations across Iraq and Syria, where we do have some indication that he was involved, including in the recent ISIS prison break operation in eastern Syria. But we will also have to take some time to observe the effect on the global ISIS apparatus. How deeply involved was he in that management? And what kind of disruptive effect does his elimination have within the broader command structure of the ISIS organization? Unfortunately, the elimination of senior leaders like this is always a temporary effect. And in this case, my concern is that it's necessary but not sufficient to cause that disruption if we don't have a strategy or the capability to then exploit that to increase pressure across the ISIS network. And in this case, we haven't seen that kind of follow through, and I don't think we're likely to, given how thin our posture is in both Iraq and Syria.
Well, thank you for that response, Jennifer. Let me turn to you, Brian Katulis, for your take. Basically, the same question. How do you think the elimination of al-Qureshi, this Haji Abdullah, to what extent does it pose a significant setback to the group? Can we gauge, or is it a bit too early? And its ability to spread its violent extremism in the region. How do you characterize the significance of the raid, its timing, and potential impact?
Well, first, two things on U.S. policy. One, the fact that this raid took place at a time when the world is fixated on another challenge, Russia's threats to Ukraine. And the Biden administration has spent a lot of time on that separate challenge, while it's also facing problems here at home. The fact that the U.S. led this raid and did this shows that we can actually do quite a lot, even if we are spread thin, as Jenny indicated. And I agree with that characterization. So this was an important raid. It shows the capabilities that America has. So that's one point about U.S. policies, that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can handle multiple challenges. Second, it also shows the value of the U.S. staying engaged, even with a diminished presence in the Middle East. Russia did not conduct this operation. Assad's government in Syria did not. America did. And for those who have argued, as we've heard in some smattering of voices on the edges of America's debate, about restraint and pull back from the Middle East, I think this shows how impractical it actually is. Because if the U.S. is not going to lead in these operations, forces like ISIS will actually continue to morph and mutate. So to the effect, I think the simple answer is it's too early to tell. It's a good move to take out a murderous leader like this. It'll likely cause more disarray temporarily inside of the organization. But as we know, it's an organization that can adapt, and it's adapted and spread in many other parts of the world beyond the Middle East, including in Africa. So it's one where I think right now America is suffering from its own internal divisions and distractions, but we should not stay distracted from the threats that ISIS continues to pose.
Well, no question about that, Ryan Katulis. The United States can walk and chew gum at the same time. In this case, we're dealing with the standoff between Russia and Ukraine. And this was a very significant action taken by the Biden administration. We know from reports that President Biden really agonized over whether or not to do this raid. He decided to do it with special forces and not via air power in order to minimize any civilian casualties. So back to you, Jennifer Caffarella. Let's step back just a minute. Al-Qureshi is, I think, about the third Daesh ISIS leader in a row that the United States has had a hand in eliminating, even as the group is supposedly on the decline, territorially speaking. We recall that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed in 2006 under the George W. Bush administration. Former President Trump hailed the elimination of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And now, of course, Biden has engineered the elimination of al-Qureshi. Jennifer, can you just remind us briefly about the origins of ISIS? You know, at one point, they held vast swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq until coalition forces defeated them. You know, how much of a threat does this group still pose and its ideology?
Yeah, I think in this case, it is important to look back and consider how many iterations of this jihadist organization the United States, our allies and partners, have already faced. Because the United States did beat this organization back to the brink of defeat, if not temporary defeat, before withdrawing from Iraq in 2011. And it was a few very short years before ISIS made a major comeback, having morphed from al-Qaeda in Iraq to the Islamic State of Iraq and into the organization we now know as ISIS, and expanded across Iraq and Syria and seized territorial control. The U.S.-led operations that defeated the physical caliphate were a very important success and, in many cases, high watermark in our ability to fight organizations like this. However, I think it's important to recognize that we are in a new phase of this organization and therefore our fight against it. And in this phase, the territorial framework is no longer, in my view, actually appropriate for assessing the strength of this organization, because ISIS undertook a deliberate transformation away from a land-owning force, recognizing that it couldn't succeed fighting as a territorial caliphate, and morphed into an insurgency. And the reason why that is significant is not only because it shows that ISIS remained capable of deliberate and phased changes in its military campaign, but also because the way of fighting, the resources required, and the metrics of success change from fighting against a land-owning force versus an insurgency. And in the phase we're in now, the political context on local levels in rural villages in Iraq and Syria and on national levels on both countries are very critical to our ability to prevent ISIS from making a major comeback and returning to a physical caliphate. And while our counterterrorism operations remain lethal and very precise and effective, we have been less successful in shaping those political conditions that could deny ISIS the continued opportunity to resurge as an insurgency. And so, unfortunately, until and unless we can fix some of the political context and the stabilization and humanitarian requirements that relate to those political contexts, we're going to struggle, and we're going to find that ISIS will have continued opportunity to root itself into some of these populations and exploit grievances that they are experiencing in the form of governance as well as security.
Turning to you, Brian Katulis, with the same question to react to what Jennifer said, is a new phase now with ISIS. It has morphed into an insurgency. And in addition to eliminating leaders and other militants, it's important that the United States and coalition partners address some of the political and economic conditions, even in the prisons, that are creating more hostility and just keeping the movement alive, not just in Syria and Iraq, but elsewhere in South Asia and in Africa. Do we have the will to continue the fight in this new framework?
We have the capacity to do it. I don't know that we have the will. And Jennifer, I think, quite accurately frames the big strategic challenge. Here we are more than 20 years, two decades after the 9/11 attacks that brought the fight against terrorists forefront in our consciousness. And 20 years later, it's now pushed to the sidelines after reemerging back in 2013, 2014, when ISIS in its earlier version emerged. So on this bigger picture question, quite frankly, I think America just does not know what it wants to do with its enormous capacity to defeat these extremist threats. And Jennifer accurately describes this as a multifaceted policy approach that's required here. But quite frankly, there's so much disarray, not only inside the Biden administration, but in America's politics, and including in America's national security think tanks, where there's just a lack of consensus about whether or not we should actually commit resources to do this. The reason why this raid happened, I would argue, the reason why we did not stay vigilant against ISIS is in part because we're so distracted by so many of our other challenges. Plus, we've had an emergence of some what I think are unhelpful and distracting voices that are using slogans, for instance, end endless wars, and we shouldn't have troops in certain places. Now, again, those voices, I think, are on the fringe. They've largely been quiet in the wake of a very successful operation like this one against the head of ISIS, because they really have nothing to offer. But their impact, I think, has been important inside of the U.S. because it's added to the disarray and confusion about America's strategic purpose in the world. And what I'm afraid will happen is that if the U.S. continues to operate with this largely tactical, operational, reactive mode against these sorts of groups, we could have another wake-up call from another major attack. These things don't go away unless we're tending to them with a clear strategy. And we can't just simply wish them away with slogans in our own political debate.
We'll be back in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Jennifer Caffarella. She's a Syria expert, and she's chief of staff and inaugural national security fellow at the Institute for the Study of War, a policy group based here in Washington, and Brian Katulis, from whom you just heard. He's vice president for policy at the Middle East Institute, a think tank also based in Washington. And I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Imran Abdullahi from Zamfara State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Jennifer Caffarella, to continue our conversation about the impact of the raid and the death of al-Qureshi. And back to Syria itself. Talk about the SDF forces, primarily Kurdish, to what extent, you know, they are true allies. And of course, there's friction between them and Turkey, who is also our ally in the region, but that poses a problem. How are they a bulwark against Daesh, ISIS, or do they pose some problems?
I think the honest answer is a mix of both, right? The Syrian Democratic Forces have fought valiantly against the Islamic State and accomplished far more, frankly, than I expected that they would be able to when they were at the time on the brink of defeat under the ISIS onslaught towards the Turkish border in 2014, 2015. They bounced back from that and have managed not only to fight to reclaim ethnically Kurdish areas, they managed to establish an umbrella coalition with Arab partners that enabled the United States and our allies to clear remaining ISIS-held areas of southeastern Syria deep into the Arab heartland. Now, there are a lot of flaws in that broader coalition and a continued imbalance that favors not only Kurdish leadership, but some of the more ideological, hardline Kurdish leadership that does have links to the broader transnational network of the PKK, which is actively fighting an insurgency against the Turkish state. So this is complicated. And the role that our local partner force in Syria plays is complicated both militarily, but also politically. And I want to come back to that because the one aspect of the fight against ISIS that the United States has not resourced is that political requirement to establish basic stability and governance. And in the absence of more robust international support, the SDF as a non-state actor has done its best. Right? They're doing their best in very tenuous circumstances to stabilize areas, to bring back basic services. And they're dealing with a series of challenges that are far beyond their capacity at current levels of international support. And that includes the crisis in the detention centers and the camps for internally displaced persons, where the SDF has rightly been warning for years now that they don't have the capacity to secure all of these prisons. They don't even have the ability to identify who they have in detention. They're not able to identify who many of these ISIS guys are, much less establish security in prisons or in camps. So what the United States is doing in Syria is allowing this partner, the SDF, to hold on to terrain. We're de-escalating best we can between that partner and Turkey, but conditions long term aren't improving. So right now we're stuck in a bit of a holding pattern and we're buying time. That time is important because it would be a lot worse if we left. But what it does is give us an opportunity to redevelop a more robust approach, a more comprehensive strategy. And unfortunately, we haven't yet seen that further build on this foundation from the Biden administration.
So, Brian Katulis, I'd like to get your take on the relationship the United States has with the Syrian Democratic Forces, our partner in the region, the difficulty, you know, in dealing with the detention centers, the fact that they've been warning the United States. And then we have all these prisoners, young men, children, many of which, you know, this is another looming problem, not just for more terrorism, but we need to address these root causes. Do you think that the United States is aware and the Biden administration, as Jenny said, will begin to address this particular issue of these prisoners, detention centers, the role of the Syrian Democratic Forces?
Yes, I think the Biden administration is aware, but I don't know that they'll do much about it. And that's my concern. Quite certainly, if we see and hear about these incidents in the prisons in our news almost on a daily basis, it's something they're aware of. This is an administration that has come into office and essentially their approach to the Middle East was to try to keep things on slow boil. In essence, they didn't want to overinvest U.S. commitments in the Middle East. The phrase that their top official at the White House, Brett McGurk, uses is back to basics. So if you're really operating with this back to basics approach, you're going to try to do the bare minimum in cases like Syria and Northeast Syria. And certainly the other slogan the Biden administration uses, putting diplomacy first, it's a nice idea. They really haven't done that in Syria. They haven't addressed some of these bigger picture issues and really shown up in the international diplomatic forums where there are discussions about Syria. They may be present, but they're not a force in the way that we were. So more broadly, there is a real challenge with that posture. If the U.S. essentially is saying we're going to try to minimize our involvement here and do the bare minimum, then that sends signals to all sorts of partners, including the SDF. And granted, under the Trump administration, in my view, President Trump's tweets and his attempts to shift Syria policy via tweet and other moves really caused a lot of damage in the relationship with actors like the SDF that America has with the SDF. Equally bad, I think, is this sense that the U.S. is just not committed, that we'll go in and we'll do certain things like this operation we're discussing, but that there really isn't much of a commitment to this because we've got a lot of problems at home. We've got problems with Russia. China's a focus. And that's a real challenge. And I think that presents a scenario where actors like the SDF and others will continue to press the limits of their own power and try to do what they feel like they need to do to advance their interests. But it is a recipe for all sorts of chaos involving any number of actors that are present inside of Syria today.
And let me refer to the role of Bashar al-Assad very quickly, Jennifer Caffarella, because, you know, we have to look back in order to understand what we're seeing now. It looks like Bashar al-Assad may be there to stay. And we can say, you know, thanks to Iran's intervention with Hezbollah in 2013, I remember just as the Free Syria Army and activists were about to defeat him and the regime, the Battle of Al-Qusayr, if memory serves me, that's when they brought in Hezbollah and really turned the tide in favor of Bashar al-Assad. Then the subsequent Russian intervention in 2015 saved Assad's security forces. And we, you know, sort of turned our attention elsewhere, if I'm not mistaken, you know, JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran, you know, seemed to overshadow. What is his role, that is Bashar al-Assad right now, in perpetuating Daesh, ISIS? It's his stated enemy, but doesn't it benefit him to some extent that our attention is on defeating the remnants of ISIS rather than holding him accountable for his internationally recognized brutality and atrocities?
Well, thank you for the question, Carol. And as usual, your memory serves you very well. That was an excellent rundown of the top lines for how we got here. And look, the bottom line is Assad destroyed his country, drove half his population, if not more, to flee, enlisted Iran and Russia in that effort, and now seeks to essentially blackmail the international community into accepting his perpetuation in nominal power. And unfortunately, Arab actors within the Middle East are aligning with that, in part because the Russians are providing incentives to realign, and in part because of an exhaustion and a lack of U.S. leadership that could stiffen resolve and provide options for actors in the region to do something other than go along with the sentiment or the feeling that Assad has managed to survive this war. I use words like feeling and in theory because the reality on the ground is quite different from the perception in the region, and especially the perception that the Russians and the Assad regime seek to portray. And while Assad has managed to survive and has indeed recaptured important parts of the country, his ability to secure those parts of the country is very minimal. And we see active insurgencies and rising instability in multiple areas, including southwestern Syria, where the Syrian revolution began and where we still see activism against the Assad regime. There is also little ability for the regime to project power eastward. Now, they will try to do that sometimes to play a spoiling role, but we are watching the most aggressive ISIS insurgency in the areas where the Assad regime, the Russians, and the Iranians are ostensibly in control. And that's in central Syria, where we've actually seen the Russians have to deploy reinforcements and reinvigorate a counter-ISIS effort multiple times without much success. And I think Assad faces a really difficult series of predicaments in reality on the ground that he's trying to solve by essentially saying, don't look too closely, I've survived the war. And the question I would pose that I think we just need to consider as events unfold here in coming weeks and months is how much Russian support he actually is going to be able to rely upon over the longer term. If Putin does indeed invade Ukraine, we could be in a situation where the Russians have less bandwidth to maintain what they've been doing in Syria. And that's a complete game changer for somebody like Assad that is still very desperately clinging to his position and still remains completely irreconcilable on any concessions that could actually create an opportunity to negotiate an end to the war.
Brian Katulis, briefly, your take on the role of Assad in all of this, in perpetuating ISIS in a sense, and the myth that, you know, he is really in charge and that at some point the United States will also have to deal with his brutality and atrocities.
It's still a very unstable country. And the actions of some of the other Arab countries in trying to reengage the Assad regime, I think, is foolhardy. It demonstrates the simple fact that they think that the United States really is not committed to the things it says it wants. For instance, the U.S. has passed legislation and there's resources dedicated to imposing costs on the Syrian regime for its atrocities. And the U.S. is not really active these days in implementing its own laws on that front. So this dynamic has produced something I've called strategic hedging on the part of some of these Arab partners that the United States has in the Gulf and in Jordan and in other places, where they essentially see the U.S. not leading, sort of washing its hands and walking away. So they're going to hedge, in a sense, with the Assad regime and with Russia that backs it. Where it becomes completely incoherent, in my view, is the role that Iran continues to play in the region, in destabilizing the region and causing all sorts of problems, not just inside of Syria for the Syrian people, but inside of Lebanon and Iraq and other places. We're at a moment where the big topic today has been the Iran nuclear deal. But Iran, you know, and its actions in the region, and especially inside of Syria, I think perpetuates this instability. And it leads us further away from the sense that the state system of the Middle East can be stable at some point. So if we ignore these dynamics, then others will continue to act in this sort of way. And then I think that just adds to the sense of chaos inside of places like Syria.
Well, that's very well said. But for now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this particular edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Jennifer Caffarella, Senior Fellow at the Institute for the Study of War, and Brian Katulis, Vice President for Policy at the Middle East Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.